It's time for Twig This Week in Google. Danny Sullivan joins us from Search Engine Land. We'll talk about the new Google homepage, what the Samsung-Apple lawsuit means for Android going forward, and a whole lot more. This Week in Google is next.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for This Week in Google is provided by CacheFly. CacheFly.com.
This is Twig, This Week in Google, episode 161, recorded August 29th, 2012. The Phantom Vibration. This Week in Google is brought to you by Stamps.com. Use Stamps.com to buy and print real U.S. postage the instant you need it, right from your desk. For our special offer, visit Stamps.com now. Click the radio microphone and enter Twig. And by GoToMyPC from Citrix. GoToMyPC connects you directly to your Office Mac or PC from any other computer or your iPad or iPhone. Sign up for a 30-day free trial today at GoToMyPC.com. Use the promo code Twig. It's time for Twig This Week in Google, the show that covers, and I got to say this right up front, because people always get mad. They say, well, it wasn't all about Google. No, it's not all about Google. It's about everything and anything that Jeff Jarvis and Gina Trapani want to talk about, and it's particularly Google, the cloud, that kind of thing. Gina Trapani is here, founding editor of SmarterWare.org. I'm sorry, she's always been the founder and editor of SmarterWare.org, but also of Lifehacker, and the author of Think Up. Hi, Gina.
Hi, good to be here.
We have decided a new feature for Gina. She's going to do the Italian recipe of the week.
Oh, okay, that works.
There we go.
Also here, Jeff Jarvis of BuzzMachine.com and of the author of Public Parts and What Would Google Do. Hello, Jeff.
Hey.
And joining us, and we always welcome him, Danny Sullivan of Search Engine Land. And you now have a whole bunch of lands. He's land rich.
Land, marketing land, too.
Marketing land. Good to have you, Danny.
Thanks for having me back.
One of the most astute observers of the Google sphere and this space in general. So, golly, where to begin? There's so much to talk about this week.
The president is doing an Ask Me Anything on Reddit.
Yeah. I think that's awesome.
I just had to say that.
Go to Reddit. It's reddit.com/r/IAMA, and right at the top there, you should see President Obama's Ask Me Anything.
Okay,
how
just
many,
had to get that out there.
How many questions did we get to before the birth certificate?
Oh, that's so silly. I love this because it's, you know, you have to, when you do an Ask Me Anything, you have to say, I am, and Ask Me Anything. And he says, I am Barack Obama, President of the United States, AMA. I love it. He actually doesn't start till 1:30 Pacific, 4:30 Eastern time. And then he says, proof it's me. And he quotes his Twitter. Isn't that funny? That's what you're supposed to do. And then he says, yes, that's I'll be taking your questions online. So that is
pretty cool.
Yeah, and it's a verified account. So we know it is the president.
Did Alexis make that happen? Or
I wonder. Who is his team? I'm sure there's a team working with him.
Yeah. They're very, very savvy.
Oh, there he is, typing on a Mac, although they've obscured the Apple. Look what they did there, except they made a mistake. He's got a magic mouse. Look at that. What did they do to the Apple? Can you zoom in on whatever that thing is? Is it an Obama logo?
It actually looks like it's just a, that's it.
Yeah.
That's it.
Not fooling anyone.
Yeah, well,
I think
like
Apple might sue the president.
Oh, and look what happened to Reddit. As soon as we said that, Reddit is under heavy load right now. Sorry. All right. Now, as long as you got my screen up, keep it up because I want to go to Google.com. And note that things have changed a little bit on the formerly clean, simple Google homepage. I'm counting, let's see, an ad for the Nexus 7 right there that bounced up. Yep. Another ad here for discover a faster way to browse the web, install Google Chrome. And now it's telling me somebody's birthday.
That's the part. That's going too far. The birthday crap is going to.
Well, where do you draw the line? Where's Marissa Meyer when we need her?
I was going to say, Marissa Meyer is turning in her new Yahoo office.
Oh, my goodness. So this is coming from Google Plus, right? These birthdays are people. I don't actually know who this is that I'm supposed to say happy birthday to.
Don Draper, it looks like.
Don Dodge.
Come on.
Don is a Google executive.
Very strange.
Well, I think what you're seeing, though, is the coming Yahoo-ization of Google.
Oh, God. Don't say that.
No, but it will. Here's what's going to happen. This is my prediction. So, you know, Yahoo makes a ton of money off of their homepage.
Right.
Huge.
Well, wait a minute.
So many people go to it.
Right. I mean, and Google has traditionally, I mean, what was it? They said millions of dollars a day that they're foregoing.
Right. And I think that's going to stop happening. Now, the ad that you see for the Nexus 7, we've had ads like that kind of thing, maybe not with the little pop-up, but they have over time done little lines underneath it like that.
Right.
So it's not even like you can write the headline like, for the first time, Google does an ad. I mean, they've...
But the pop-up is a little
more.
I know, the pop-up is a bit different, but I think actually the more significant thing is what's going to happen with the birthdays. I think what's going to happen is, in a year from now, you're going to log into Google Plus, because we will all have accounts at that point, and Google is going to show you a different homepage. You're going to go to Google to do a search, the Google homepage, and they're going to say that, hey, because you're on Google Plus, we've now put the best of Google Plus into the Google homepage. And you'll get things like not just a little birthday notification, but maybe what's hot on Google Plus. And slowly and gradually, but what will happen is the Google homepage will turn into being this portal page.
Then
they'll be able
to
have ads out there. They'll be able to promote Google Plus out there. But they'll say that they're only doing it for people with Google Plus accounts, so that the classic Google homepage will remain the way it is, and they can still kind of say, well, no, it's still all clean. It's still all new. It's not, you know, not anything different. But yet they'll tap into this huge amount of inventory that they pretty much haven't been able to use.
Didn't they just kill that with whatchamacallit? What was the homepage they killed?
iGoogle.
Well, that's exactly. They killed iGoogle, right? Good way to get rid of it. Because nobody really kind of used it. You never necessarily got forced into it. It wasn't really growing. But this will be what will come down the line. This will be the iGoogleization of the Google homepage, or the Google Plusification of the Google homepage. That's really the better thing that's going to happen, is that I think you're going to see Google Plus start to move out and take over that homepage, so that when you go to google.com and you are logged in, it's not just going to be a search box. It's going to be, here's what's hot on Google Plus. And that'll be another way of them to help promote the Google Plus social network too.
So what happened? Because Google has chewed this for so long and turned down millions and millions of dollars. What happened to Google that they changed their tune?
Want to make more money?
Yeah, but they could have made more money any time in the last 8 years. Why all of a sudden?
For them to do it. Now it's like, who are they having to compete against to be a portal like that? AOL? Yahoo? I mean, you know, now that they've, you know, they haven't necessarily done it, but now that you've had a lot of these things sort of go away and you're looking at the landscape, what are they competing with? They're competing with people who are going into things like Facebook and starting their day at a Facebook by seeing everything that's showing up. All right. Well, that's what Google Plus is in part supposed to do for them. But if you're trying to entice more people into it who aren't necessarily going there, you start leveraging your homepage. I think what happens in their minds is that they look at these different things very individually. That they'll say, well, we're putting this stuff out on the Google homepage because it's in the benefit of the user, and we're showing more stuff for them, and that's going to help with discovery, and that's going to help with all sorts of stuff. And they don't tend to look back on it like, wait a minute, didn't we say we were never going to do this, and there were reasons why we were never going to do this? And, you know, to be fair, sometimes reasons do change. But that's why I think you see this sort of thing happening.
And then the chat room's saying reasonably, well, who cares? Because nobody uses the Google homepage. We all use the browser search.
Right? Yeah, well, I was just going to say, I mean, the entry point to Google search isn't, you know, I think that the homepage is on decline, not because they're adding crap to it, but because people don't use it right as much. I mean, there are so many other entry points in a Google search. And if you look at what Google's doing with Google Now, that's them trying to anticipate what is relevant to you right now. What do you want to know? So you want to know if it's one of your friends' birthdays. I also agree that that's just not something I want on my Google.com homepage.
But you can control it in the Google Now, and you can say, I don't want to see that card again. And I actually love Google Now. I don't know why that's different from my mind than the Google homepage.
That's a really good
clean.
Point.
Yeah.
Well, Google Now is a totally new product, and you expect that it's trying to anticipate what you're going to ask for.
Right.
And I think that's kind of, I mean, these things are all sort of merging, you know, into Google's, just like Jeff's talked about, you know, for 160 episodes, you know, they want to divine your intent, right? And they want to use all the signals they can. And so now they have this whole social graph, right, through Google Plus. So they want to, you know, show you stuff that they think you're going to want to know. And of course, well, the Nexus 7 advertisement is just them trying to, you know, tweak sales. Yeah.
They want to sell it while they can before Amazon comes out with its new Kindle and Apple comes out with its iPad mini.
Exactly.
There's two things here. One is that Google has still not sold its homepage. That would be a huge Rubicon to pass.
That's a good point. This is all Google stuff.
It's Google stuff, and they're promoting their stuff. And they get crap for promoting their stuff, but they're doing that.
Earthquake.
The second thing is,
did you just have an earthquake, Danny?
I have an earthquake.
where are you located?
Newport Beach. That was definitely a quake.
You felt it pretty strongly?
Yeah, you guys go on. We're having swarms down here. Gina, you should feel it.
Yeah,
no, I'm looking at my hanging plant. It hasn't moved. I'm not feeling it here.
I'm checking my smoking
dogs. Because you had some strong ones the other day.
Well, maybe my imagination. Anyway, go ahead. I'm sorry.
Let's look at the real-time earthquake map and just...
And the earth moved for me. I don't know.
The earth moved under his feet. The real-time earthquake map is not showing anything right now.
Yeah,
it'll
take about a minute.
There was a big cluster in your area.
Well, they've been having a lot out in Brawley.
Brawley, that's where it is.
Yeah. Here we are, 2057. No, that's too later. Hmm. Anyway, I'll hang in there. It might have been just my imagination. I'm sure.
Isn't it funny if you start having earthquakes, and people are wondering what we're talking about, but if you start having earthquakes in your area, you feel them then all the time. Phantom earthquake.
Mm-hmm.
It's like a phantom phone buzz, yes.
I feel, now, can we just talk about the phantom phone buzz? Because I thought I was the only one afflicted by that.
Oh, I get it all the time.
And now I hear that this is actually a thing.
Yes.
So I feel like I have my phone in my pocket, and I feel like it's buzzing.
When I don't have it in my pocket, that's when I know I'm nutty. I feel the buzz.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Well, then we know it's not real.
You people are crazy.
You've never felt that?
I don't. I have an aversion to voice calls, so.
No, it's not. It's just a buzz. It could be anything.
It's a buzz or like a notification. Okay. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Yeah. I kind of have an aversion to those, too. But yeah, no, I'm not.
Huh. Others in our chat room say they are feeling the phantom vibration. And Chad, you feel it too. Isn't this funny? We are all subject to this and nobody really knew it until somebody said it. And then now we go, oh, yeah, I got that.
Well, yeah. I mean, I got that. Nope. Yeah, we talked about that way.
Oh, we have.
Is it a thing? Me and my friends, I remember before I moved out to California.
There we are.
It is in your Belinda. All right. Oh, yeah, here it is. 5 kilometers south of Brawley. Boy, there's a big cluster. Yeah, 4-1s, you'd feel that. So it's not a phantom buzz. It's the real deal.
I thought I was getting earthquakes all the time, and then I realized that it was my dryer that was moving the house.
You know, was that the note you couldn't fit in your pocket or something?
Yeah, I tried.
Yeah.
I broke out the note because, of course, one of the stories will be the new note.
Oh, that's so small.
It's so tiny. How do you survive? How do you live with such a small phone? And we'll talk about the new note in a little bit. Gosh, earthquakes, phantom vibrations in the Google homepage. Item number one. Wow.
Let me say this about the homepage. I think I'll just go too far because that's what I do here. I think all homepages die. The notion of a homepage is there because you have to have one, like you have to have cinder blocks under a house or something. But it's just not part of what you do. It's happening with news sites like crazy. No one goes to the homepage. They're all coming in elsewhere. Or your real homepage is on Twitter, Facebook, et cetera. And the people, all these companies spend all this effort going to homepages. If anybody comes to them as a destination, including media, and you know, if you're the New York Times, they do. But otherwise, no, they don't. So I think the homepage is absolutely meaningless. And Google in that sense is far ahead.
I think that we all will use Chrome and we'll search with it and we'll go with it. But there are lots of people going to the Google homepage still.
There must be.
If they weren't, they wouldn't be bothering doing this sort of thing.
Well, I think it depends on the page. I go to the homepage of TechMeme every day. That's a homepage. But, of course, it links deep into the page that I'm – that I should be. So if I don't go to the Verge homepage, I go to TechMeme's homepage, and that links deep into the Verge. So
I was talking with somebody I work with today, and he said it well. I mean, if you think about a site, not as a site, but as an API, which, you know, Dave Weiner's talked
that's
about.
That's RSS.
Well. Yeah. It's RSS. It's a stream. It's a river. It's a hooks into something. Then, yeah, you may have a page, and it's your page, and it's the one you go to, but your page is like no one else's. And that's where iGoogle was starting to go. This goes back to what Denny was saying. So maybe the new experience you have with Google is indeed Google Plus. And by the way, yeah, you have a search box there too.
Okay. I mean, yeah. There you go. There's not that much more to say about the new Google homepage, except that it is the new Google homepage.
Yeah.
You know, and it's theirs to mess with.
Just a bit. I was pulling up some things here. They have promoted as far back as like 2005 different things. They promoted Firefox.
Right. I remember that.
Google Toolbar. Yeah. They promoted Google Pack. Everybody remember Google Pack?
Oh, yeah. Google Pack.
Google Pack. Google Video content from NBA and CBS. They promoted a Da Vinci Code contest that they had going on out there. The G1, when it came out, was promoted there. The Nexus One. The Droid. Was promoted on the page as well. So they promoted lots of things that are there. And that Meyer quote, it was when she said it was, there will never be banner ads on the Google homepage. This is in 2007. There will never be crazy, flashy, graphical doodads flying and popping up all over the Google site ever. And, you know, it's 2012. We've moved on.
It was a long time ago. And remember, yeah. We were all playing Pac-Man and the Google Doodle.
No one was complaining about that.
Nope.
That
right.
was fun.
It wasn't an ad, that's why.
Yeah.
I should do an ad right now. No, I'm... No ads. No ads today. Throwing out the ads.
There you go. No, don't tell me we have no ads.
No, I don't know, actually. I don't have the right... clipboard.
That would be bad news, Dale. That's
the wrong
very
show.
Bad news.
Google has once again disclosed all the people they gave money to in the Oracle Google suit, including, I'm sad to say, the guy at Foss Patents. Who he was being paid by Google or Oracle? I can't remember.
Oracle.
Yeah. And I still like Foss Patents. But it's just kind of depressing when you find out,
but a lot of them were, that was the point, is Google at first said, well, nobody. And so then they came back and they said, okay, well, this person who's an employee of ours did talk about this case. And this person, you know, like Lauren Weinstein, you know, we've done things with him in the past. And he, using his free speech, has talked about the case. There was no one-for-one that said Google paid anybody to talk about the case, was there?
Well, here's the one that the Mark Lemley, he's a Stanford professor. Who apparently is oft quoted without saying he's getting money from Google. Then Google says, well, he's our outside counsel.
He's sort
of
like a contractor?
Of
yeah.
And part of this is because Google initially told the court in the Oracle trial that it hadn't paid anyone to comment on the case.
Right.
But parse that exactly. That says that we paid you to write about the case.
Right.
And I, unless I'm wrong and I read it very quickly, I didn't see a case of that. They saw, okay, all right, if you insist, here's people who've written about the case with whom we have a business relationship.
So really, it doesn't come down to, in my opinion, it doesn't come down to Google. It comes down to Florian Mueller at Foss Patents or Mark Lemley when they blog about the case to say, oh, no, by the way, I'm outside counsel for Google. Or, oh, by the way.
Kara Swisher. I mean, you know, Kara Swisher is very good about that, including her personal relationships.
Right. Yeah. In fact, if you go to All Things D, you almost can't avoid the ethics disclosures. They're big, fat links. Mm-hmm. Pop-ups sometimes. So I don't know what to say about this. It did seem like it was a little indirect. It wasn't like, here, some money. Go say nice things about us.
So dumb question. Don't lawyers pay experts to testify?
Yes.
Like to offer their opinion in cases all the time?
Yes.
But that's generally the law firm pays?
Well, it's understood that if you're coming on to testify, you're a paid expert. In fact, okay. I think they often, and if they don't, the opposing counsel will say, well, you're a paid expert.
You'll be declared a paid expert.
Yeah.
I've done those sorts of cases in legal things before.
It's not hidden.
Yeah, they know. But in this case, the court was really trying to understand experts that might be speaking about the case and writing about the case that were paid, that were not providing legal testimony, so they wouldn't have been declared. The key difference seemed to be, if I understood the case with false patents, is that he was actually hired to do consulting for Oracle on it and was writing, to whereas I don't think, from what I understood, the outside counsel was hired just specifically for that case. But, you know, I could be wrong on that as well. But, you know, I guess we have more clarity as to what we didn't have before on both sides of it. It was kind of late coming into the case to ask for all that, though.
Yeah, it was like when it was over.
Right.
Basically. Can somebody get my... I must have some commercials today. I do. Okay.
Please, God.
Please, from your lips to God's ear.
Then I'm going to have to start paying you for the pleasure of being here.
I do have one. Thank you. No, I have two. That's wonderful. Why don't we do one now? That way we will... Then we will pay some bills. This is not exactly on our homepage. Actually, it is, come to think of it, on our homepage.
You are our homepage.
If you go to twit.tv, I do believe there is, in fact, a display ad. We were talking about the value or non-value of display ads on Twit on Sunday. It was very great, actually, great conversation, which Adam Curry... Oh, look, there's a picture of you and Gina on our front page.
Aww.
Aww. You're kind of obscured, Gina. I apologize.
It's okay.
Same, but I guess you took your lighting down too much, Gina.
Yeah.
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 You had to pull the blinds.
Yeah. Our show brought to you today by our folks at Citrix, our good friends at Citrix, who do a fabulous remote access app. If you're an enterprise, you probably know the name Citrix because they are the most famous remote access company in the world. They pretty much invented the business many moons ago. Microsoft licensed Citrix software for their remote desktop. Citrix makes very easy to use remote access product called GoToMyPC, which is misnamed because it works for both PCs and Macs. In fact, if you're about to head out of town, this would be a good time to install GoToMyPC on your office computer, because then as you hit the road, you can access that office computer anywhere, log on to any computer or your iPhone, iPad, and Android tablet, and access your office computer. That is pretty amazing. When you're looking at your office computer on a tablet and you're doing everything you could do at work, you can run any program, send and receive email, access any network resource. That is the coolest thing ever. I want you to try it free right now. Visit the GoToMyPC website. Click the Try It Free button. The promo code is TWIT, and we want you to use that just so that Jeff and Gina get credit, full credit. Promo code T, did I say twit? Twig, T-W-I-G. See, I blew it again. T-W-I-G gives them credit. And I think you will be very happy. Easy to install. You don't need the IT department. You do not need to open up ports in your router or anything like that. It uses a very sophisticated NAT traversal technology. Look, see, it looks nice on your tablet there. Nexus 7 looks beautiful. Go to mypc.com. Use the offer code TWIG. T-W-I-G. Google crisis map for Hurricane Isaac. I guess it's been downgraded to a tropical storm. But Google's done, as they have done in the past, they've done websites, part of their Google crisis response. In fact, it's google.org, which is interesting, / crisis map. Yeah. And boy, it's really cool what they do here. I think I first became aware of this during the Haiti earthquake. Yeah. So you can click on active shelters, New Orleans levee system, evacuation information, user-generated content. You want to see YouTube videos? There they are. Isn't that cool?
Compare this with a news article.
I know.
Right? It's just so much more informative. It has so much more stuff. And it's embeddable and open.
Yeah. Isn't it amazing? I just really love what they've... Here's the USS Alabama Battleship Park webcam. So you can see the webcam and see the storm coming in. They've got the path of the storm. This is really, really, really amazing.
They've gotten really good at this. I mean, even over the course of just doing the show for, 2 years or 3 years, we've seen Google get so good at being able to come up with these single-serving sites during crises that are just, you know, beautiful visualizations. Informative.
Yeah, if you're an information junkie, we live in wonderful times. Look at that.
And I think Google's relationship to the news industry is what I always think about, of course. But I think that becomes really important because they just become a supplier of
raw information.
Now they charge people though. I was watching CNN and they had it said big letters Google Map, and I'm sure they're paying for that, right?
I don't know.
I think so.
I don't know. I think it was before use on the web, but I think the promotion is valuable too.
Yeah, but I think they actually pay for it, so it's a not revenue much. Source as well. Yeah. Well, Google's killing the weather API, which is kind of interesting. Instead, you're going to use Weather Underground, I guess.
Right.
Mm. That's too bad. I actually use Google's weather service a lot, although I ended up using AccuWeather on one of my widgets because it was more reliable. So if you click, if you're using iGoogle and you click on the weather, you'll get Weather Underground, not Google's API now.
Was that the only place that they were using it?
No, like I said, they had an API. So I had a widget, my beautiful weather widget.
On my Android phone,
and you had a choice in the weather widget whether you use Google for your weather information or AccuWeather, and I always ended up choosing AccuWeather because they didn't match. So maybe Google didn't have the, I don't know, maybe they didn't have the best weather. Let me see if it's still here. Widget settings, weather. Oh, I don't know. Maybe I'm looking in the wrong place. Weather settings. Here it is. Weather service. Choose between AccuWeather and Google. Yeah.
Mm.
So that was the API. But I always chose AccuWeather anyway. The API apparently has been quietly closed down by Google. So if you query the weather API, you'll get an error message. We're sorry, but your computer or network may be sending automated queries. To protect our users, we can't process your request right now. See Google Help for a nice Python script.
I got a question for you, Danny, since you cover Google so magnificently. If that happened at a media company, then the people who did that product would be fired. But I never hear that coming out of Google. And I sense it's because people, when they start at Google, don't go to a particular job. They come to Google, then get placed. And if their job goes away, then they get placed somewhere else. Has this led to any displacement of people's losing jobs?
Well, here's one. Currently in.net. This is the website. If you go to currentlyin.net, which I guess was a website where you could say, what's the temperature currently in?
Right.
Currently down. Google has shut down its undocumented weather API. Ah, undocumented. That's a key word.
Yeah, that's interesting. Like, I didn't know that there was a weather API, and apparently this was a private API.
Ah.
Well,
then they can't be held responsible.
It's kind of all bets are off at that point.
Yeah, I mean, it was... To be honest, I didn't even realize they were running a weather API, so I didn't think it was that much of a deal. But in terms of them, you mean if they shut down a product, Jeff, do people get fired?
Right.
Or do they just find another home for them? Yeah, Google Wave. People don't get fired from Google. They just move on to other
things.
They
go to Facebook.
Because Google doesn't seem to find a reason to kind of want them to stick around. There's any number of Googlers that left to go to some other company, and it was a big splash, and then it was, aha, see, Google is losing people. And part of this story in that is also that Google might not have minded losing them. Because when Google does mind losing people, sometimes it really pulls out all the stops and it tries to keep them. So I think the Google Wave folks were a good example of that. We put every single thing. I mean, there was nothing they could not put behind Google Wave. I think it would be hard to argue they didn't get behind that in a big way. And the product really didn't take off. And at that point, it was like, well, we don't really have anything else to go here. And nobody got fired that I heard of. There's always talent that's going on there. But you just may not feel like you need to go out of your way to retain that talent and go further with it from that. And Marissa's probably the best example of this now, right? I mean, here she is running, Yahoo. And she was a talent, and sometimes people can talk about and have some debates on her management style and was she credited with doing all the things or she wasn't credited doing it or whatever, but the bottom line is there was nothing left at Google to kind of retain her, and she's gone off somewhere else.
Right.
So
that's you'd expect that in a business, right? They're not gonna if somebody doesn't have a place to go, they let them go or they disappear.
Well, you'd expect that, but then you'd also get an impression that Google fought that hard to try to retain her, right? I mean, there was this shift that went around where she seemed to be moved off into local product. They still had other people doing local products or whatever. And again, there's been some debate on whether or not she was sort of sidelined or whatnot with it from there. And I think that on both sides, the departure has been very positive. You know, that nobody has been saying any negative things about each other on either side of it. And there's a big argument that it's hard to figure out what you do with someone like that who, you know, really probably sees their next challenge running a company like Yahoo rather than running yet another division of Google. But, you know, there still isn't that sort of retention, because imagine that, I don't know, other Google execs that might be around that are actually very powerful that have been put in a position of power suddenly decided that, well, you know, I want to go off and do something else. I think there'd be much more stops that would be pulled out with it from there.
Counter. No. I'm looking for the next story. Let's talk about the Galaxy Note. Samsung had a big event this morning at IFA, which is a big trade show in Berlin. I'm not sure what IFA stands for. International Phone.
It's German.
And the Samsung Mobile Unpacked event, they announced quite a few things. There were live blogs. There's a guy doing card tricks. Something you won't see at an Apple keynote, I don't think.
International Funkhausstellung.
It's the Funkhausstellung. There you go.
Funk is distance. So it's basically communications, but it's another word. Right? And Ausstellung is a conference display of things.
Now I'm sad I didn't go, because the event opened with Wim Wenders, one of my favorite film directors, who for some reason unaccountably has been appearing in teaser videos for the Galaxy Note.
Because as you walk by Berlin and you see these things, you need a way to note it,
yes,
and create.
Is it Das Kinder was, Das Kinder wasen, or whatever it is. He was the director of Wings of Desire, which was a beautiful movie.
You'd be happy to know, by the way, Google Translate translates International Funkenstellung into IFA.
IFA. You were talking about IFA.
I kid you not. That's exactly what it
is. That's the right translation. So I guess Wim Wenders has, you're right, Jeff, been doing drawings, a five-day effort to recreate Berlin in drawings on the Note. You know, one of the things that I liked about the Note is they've always really focused on not business but creativity. When they introduced the Note originally at CES last year, they had artists, they had ateliers all over Las Vegas with people doing sketches on the Note, which I thought was cool. And I really like the Note. It was my phone of choice for some time until the S3 came out. The new Note is kind of a merger of the S3 and the original Galaxy Note. 1280 by 720, which is not a very high DPI. I mean, it's the same as actually as the S3, but on a 5.5-inch screen. They are using now a non-Pentile Super AMOLED display. So that's a good thing, but it's still a Super AMOLED. It has a quad-core 1.6 gigahertz Exynos processor, which makes it, as far as I know, the fastest phone out there. And a 3,100 milliamp hour battery, which is also the fattest battery in a phone. So I will order one as soon as it's available. They didn't say when it would be available, but the thinking is perhaps
It's going to be sold in Europe first.
In Europe, as they did with the Note originally and the Galaxy S3 originally.
Well, let me ask you again. So that means that when you get it, you won't be 4G or super speed.
Now, this one, I think you might be 4G, but the frequencies would be wrong, because they do say this is a 4G.
That's what I'm saying. So you can't really get 4G.
Right. You'll be getting HSPA Plus on T-Mobile or AT&T. I don't care about that much. I can't get 4G. I'm in Petaluma. I got nothing.
Jelly Bean. That's great.
Jelly Bean, which is a little bit of a surprise. We didn't expect that. Or at least some of the rumors were that it would still be ice cream sandwich. It's beautiful.
I wonder if the trial affected that.
Ah. You know what? I bet it did.
Good point. I'll bet it will come without some of the Samsung stuff, right, Gina?
Yeah, that's what I'm wondering. If it's pure Jelly Bean or if Samsung
It said TouchWiz, and I'm looking at it, and that looks like TouchWiz on there. In fact, it is definitely. TouchWiz is weird because it puts the apps icon on the right instead of in the middle, as every other phone does. To color back, they're going to have the S Pen, and it does new things. It has a hover mode. Look at that, though. That is thin and light, and it looks a lot like a Galaxy S3 with a engorged screen. I will be getting one. I really like the note.
I'm eager. I was out today with on the streets of New York and put this in my back pocket, looking incredible.
This is a good compromise.
It's the diagonal pocket protector but you know, I love having this with me, but it is just a hair too big to carry around credibly, and being able to carry that around, I think it may be a magic size.
I like the note. 2 gigs of RAM as opposed to the gig of RAM in the original Note, and I think in the S3. So that's a lot of RAM. I don't know if Jelly Bean requires it or what. It's available in 260 partners in 128 countries in October, and then somewhat later in the U.S., just as the S3 was. So that's interesting. Samsung is maybe back on its heels a little bit after the Apple Samsung decision. I guess we should talk about that. I feel like I've talked about it, but because
you're talked out about it.
Well,
I bet you are.
It happened on Friday, and I immediately ran, and we did not expect. We thought, oh, it'll be later this week. I thought it'd be after Twig this week, because I mean, how could a jury possibly rule on something after 3 weeks of testimony, 109 pages of jury instructions, 33 question, 20 page verdict form? Couldn't possibly decide that in 3 days. They did. And came back. And now that we've heard from the jury, they apparently didn't understand the case at all. But that's okay, because I think that in hindsight, they probably made the right decision. They said they were most influenced by the emails from the Samsung executives when the iPhone came out, saying there's a crisis in design, we've got to respond to this. They said that to them was evidence, proof positive, that Samsung set out to copy the iPhone. And it's true that the earliest Samsung phones looked an awful lot like the iPhone. And I think that's what swayed them. They were not ruling on newer phones like the Galaxy S3 or the Galaxy Note. They were ruling on patents that were affecting the most recent phone it affected was the Galaxy S2. The judge will decide on December 6th. He's going to have another hearing on whether some of those phones that are still being sold will be blocked in the U.S. That's unknown. She also has the right to triple the damages because the jury ruled that the infringement was willful. $1.05 billion in damages. The judge could make that $3 billion plus. And finally, and I think it's maybe underreported, the jury decided that none of the tablets violated Apple patents, only the phones. Any thoughts, anybody? Danny, what do you think? I'm sure you've also talked out on this subject.
The patent stuff, largely, I just had left to others. It got into so many different nuances and these different debates. I think the big takeaway from this was really the Google response that came back saying, you know, this isn't going to go to core Android. I think some people have taken this like, aha, now Android's dead. And no, it's not necessarily dead. This seems to be going to certain design aspects of, you know, the icon, certain design aspects in terms of whether you do the pinch to zoom, that sort of stuff. And, you know, it looks like these are things that you can work around. And in fact, some people are working around. And one of the crazy things I found with the S3 that I've been testing is that they've got all this TouchWiz stuff, and if I throw my phone in the air and clap 3 times, it'll send a message for me, to whereas if I bounce it twice on my desk, they've got all these new gesture things in there that almost feel like they're trying to come up with gestures that weren't gestures that anybody else might have. And I don't know. I tend to strip a lot of this stuff off anyway and just use it straight. So, you know, I think the Android operating system is going to continue on. I think this will be more of a road bump or a speed bump to it. I'm sure Samsung would be a heck of a lot happier if they didn't have all the jokes about, well, I guess you just copied Apple, coming off to them. But it's not going to be this sort of big reversal, I don't think. And, you know, I think it's also interesting that for all the upset that Apple sort of had with it, these things seem to be relatively minor into why people would have actually picked a Samsung phone over an iPhone. I mean, I just haven't seen anything in general people saying, oh, well, thank goodness it had pinch to zoom. That's what made me pick. When I
talk to people about why, because I always, when I see people with phones, I'm always like, why do you have that phone? Why do you have this phone? And it's like, it was small.
Right.
Right. Right. No, it was big. Right. It was, you know, it was cheap. I'm with my carrier. It was like the things that had nothing to do with the things that you would expect them to go for the iPhone. It just amazes me sometimes because I find the iPhone to be a really, really great experience. And so I, you know, to me, the biggest downside to it tends to be that it doesn't have LTE. So when I see people not, and I say that as somebody who uses an Android phone on a regular basis, and I still, when I go back to the iPhone, I kind of like almost breathe a sigh of relief because a lot of it feels very intuitive and very elegant, very clean, and I'm not having to struggle with it. So I'm, you know, but there's more to people making their choices than just beyond, hey, it's awesome iPhone, that's why I'm going for it. Not everybody agrees with that.
Well, a lot of it is price. I mean, do you guys buy, I think Mike Elgin repeated a lot of these posts on Google+. The idea that the overhearing people saying, yeah. Well, gee, if they're the same, I should have spent a lot less to get an Android.
Yeah, I thought that was funny.
I thought that was really anecdotal, though. I mean, yeah. it was a yeah. fascinating post where it was Mike or somebody who was saying, I was in a Starbucks and I heard four different people come in and they all were talking about the news. And if it was exactly the same, I paid how much for this computer or whatever.
Right.
But
I don't buy that.
You know,
I'm not sure.
There's more to the gadgets, especially especially with the Apple devices. I think what's happening is that they've built up this entire ecosystem of my phone can talk to my computer that can talk to the iCloud, which can talk to my Apple TV. I'm buying all my content through it. I'm locking it in there. Now I've got 2,000 music songs that I bought that are all in the cloud. And I think that's going to be much more important as to why you're going to stay with a particular device than another device. That's also why I think the Nexus 7 was such an important thing for Google, because it really should have been called the Google Play in some ways, because it really crystallized what they did with Google Play, which was to say, you know, we don't have an Android market anymore. We have this thing called Google Play, and it's where you buy content through Google. And it's where you can get your movies and all your stuff or whatever. And it's not an Android-specific type of thing. And that's sort of our iTunes that comes with it. And the Google Play and the Nexus 7 itself kind of really crystallized that. I think when you turn that thing on and it's like your content is the main screen that you see, it just really highlights that what one of the focuses in these devices isn't just what they necessarily do in terms of can I bounce back or can I, you know, pinch the zoom, but where can I get my content streaming to them through it.
Yeah, I think consumers are smarter than both simultaneously smarter and dumber than we think. I think they know the difference. They completely know the difference. And a lot of the things we care a lot about, they couldn't care less about. And they make decisions for a lot of, you know, simpler reasons. What do you think about the decision, Jeff Jarvis, Samsung versus Apple?
I was just disappointed in the war where we find ourselves. I think Samsung's response that, gee, it's amazing that you can own rectangles with rounded edges. I think we've lost the sense of the definition of innovation.
Right.
And you know, is design innovation? Well, sure, Apple has proved that oftentimes, but I think that we're protecting the wrong things. And we talked last week about copyright, and I argued that it should change to a notion of protecting credit. That's easier to think of in text and ideas. You know, the bigger question to me, and I don't know what to think about this, I honestly don't. Are we past the idea of ideas as property and ownership? What would the world look like if we didn't have that doctrine? And I'm not sure I like that world. I'm not sure I want that world. I'm not necessarily advocating that. But none of this is helping do what it's supposed to do, which is spur innovation and get innovation made public and shared. It's doing the opposite.
Right.
But could this be good for Google, though? I mean, could this decision discourage manufacturers from trying to make products that look. I have to tell you, I kind of agree with the jury. I mean, I didn't follow the trial very closely the whole way, but you look at some of the pictures of those phones. I remember when that phone came out, thinking like, wow, they're clearly just trying yeah. to make a low end iPhone. That was my gut reaction to it. And I think Farhad Manju wrote a great piece.
I loved what Farhad said. Yes.
I mean, you know, when the iPhone was a big hit, you know, companies had three choices: do nothing, try to copy it, or try to, you know, invest the R&D to make something more innovative. And it looks like Samsung kind of chose path number two, and now they're paying for it. And, you know, this decision was not about Android, right? It was about these particular Samsung products. And I think, you know, Google sees Jelly Bean as kind of the solution to their lawsuit problems, because Jelly Bean really is starting to differentiate itself, very much so, right, from iOS. And so in a way, this kind of discourages, this may encourage more manufacturers to stick either with the pure Google experience or to make an experience that looks very different. I think that's a good thing. I want things that are different.
Yeah. No, I agree. I think the jury, even though they did it for the wrong reasons, did the right thing. Samsung knew it. They thought the $1 billion fine, even if it's a $3 billion fine, is in effect their R&D budget for their early smartphones. It gave them enough leverage in the market. They became the number two, in fact, now number one smartphone company. And it's clear with things like the Note and the Galaxy S3, they're innovating.
Samsung just a proxy, though? Was this really against Samsung?
Well, that's a good question. Why not sue Google?
Yeah.
Oh, I read something like you can't really sue Google because they didn't have a product.
They didn't make phones. Case right.
Yeah.
You could sue them, but you wouldn't get any damages, because the damages are based on commercial losses. They're not punitive. Mm. It's what did this cost in the marketplace, and you can't prove that Google cost anybody anything because they didn't sell anything. But I think that also it's clear that the jury was really punishing TouchWiz and Samsung. I don't think this was Google by proxy.
No. I just fear what comes next. Is Apple now emboldened?
No, I think they're exhausted. And I think I'm hoping that what will actually happen is that everybody will come down to the table. Okay, we proved our point. Now let's license. We're not going to ask.
Let's hope.
Yeah. And everybody will sit down at the table and we're just going to handle this.
Yeah, I'll take bounce back scrolling. You take the 3G patent. Right.
And I think Samsung's taken that stuff out. Steve Gibson was pointing out there's no bounce back scrolling in the Nexus 7.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't. That's Apple's patent. They didn't put it in here. It doesn't bounce back.
Is there tap zoom? There is, isn't there? Certainly pinching.
Yeah, that's an interesting point. The tap zoom is cool. That's the thing that means that when you're looking at a small version of a website, let me do this in Chrome. You're looking at a small version of a website, and you want to zoom in on a paragraph. I got to find some text here. Let's do this. Unfortunately, all of this is already zoomed.
Go to a newspaper story.
Yeah, you got to go to like CNN or something. Yeah. NY Times. This is the Nexus 7, of course. So this is what Apple invented, really, was we're going to render the whole page, and then you want to read this article, you double tap it. You see, it doesn't zoom exactly like Apple did. Apple would zoom like that.
Right,
That's not necessarily, it depends on what you're looking at. Go to a particular article. If you double tap, it'll zoom into the whole article content. Give it a second. Just let it load. Now tap
okay,
on the
now,
article.
Let's say hopefully I want to read this paragraph. On the iPhone, Danny, wouldn't if I double tap that paragraph, it would fit that to the width of the screen, right?
I think it'll bring the whole article up. Double tap. Let me see what happens.
Because the column above, it did a jog. So it is, in fact, fitting the left and right.
Here, so let's take this paragraph. Yeah, it did the full thing there. I don't know.
But just the squeeze that, and I need to go back through, but the things like the pinch and the multi-gesture, I mean, those were things that I remember when the iPhone first came out that were like, wow.
Right.
This is the first time I've ever seen this sort of stuff.
It was
those were the distinguishing points. And I think the difficulty is, you know, you say, well, should you be able to patent something like that? Doesn't make sense. But, you know, I don't know who invented like the telephone keypad that got us off of dialing, right? But at some point somebody said, hey, why don't we do touch tones? And why don't we have a touch tone pad? And maybe we should patent that sort of thing. And then somebody else comes along and, you know, may say, right, well, that's obvious. You should have that. I'm going to make that too. And well, it wasn't necessarily obvious to the person who created it. And where do you go about making sure that somebody who came up with that idea actually does get paid for it or does get to be able to license it or whatever, as opposed to somebody else saying, oh, well, I'll just make all the push buttons circular. And then now that's fine. Or I'll you know.
But Danny, it's also about the norms that we use ourselves. So let's say that, you know, who owns OK? Right. We all know that means okay if you're really dorky and old, because nobody actually does it anymore, but I could think of an example.
That is kind of old-fashioned.
Right? So now hand gestures that mean something to your computer. Oh, well, now that it means something to a computer, not to a human, now we can own that. So obviously turning the page, bing, bing. Is that something you really own? Yeah, fine. You enabled it, but you took a human behavior that makes sense to humans, and you gave them that back, and so you should be able to restrict anybody else from getting
that. No, because patent law says if it's obvious to an expert in the arts, then it can't be patented.
Well, but that's what the argument with the Samsung case was. Much of it was really not about patents at all. It was about design.
Design is another. You're right. Design, patents, trade dress, that's a different issue. And that only comes down to, did Samsung try to confuse consumers by making it look the same?
Right.
But in terms of software patents, I mean, by the way, that's a separate conversation from Samsung Apple, because Samsung Apple is about the law as it stands today. And it won. Apple won, and based on the law as it stands today. No, should we change the law? Absolutely. 17 years for a software patent? What? That's crazy. If you have software patents at all. But the law does say if it's obvious, it has to innovate. It has to be something clever and innovative.
That's
otherwise,
what I'm saying is I think that we've gotten away from the definition of innovation. We've lowered the bar of the definition of innovation so far that rounded rectangles, to use Samsung's example, is now called innovative.
Right.
And innovative, sorry. British influence. So there is a matter of interpretation there. So the law says be innovative, and how the judge and jury interprets what is innovative is something that is still on the horizon.
It's true, but you know, like Danny said earlier, you know, I remember that the earliest iPhone commercials when they were showing full web pages on Safari on the phone and being able to tap.
That was cool.
Was cool. I remember reacting to that and being like, oh, that's, you know, And I think that the most like innovative design and successful designs seem so obvious in retrospect.
Right.
You know, I mean, certainly I wasn't designing touchscreen, you know, apps at that time. And you know, and I wonder if you would put, you know, if you would put 10 different touchscreen designers in separate rooms and said, okay, what would happen on these different actions, or what actions would a user use? Many of them, you know, a few of them may come up with the same solutions that Apple came up with, but you know, even that bounce back scrolling, I was talking about this with my wife. She was like, that just seems so obvious. And I was like, well, but not back in 2006 when, you know, these things that didn't exist.
Okay. But here's another way to look at it then. Web 8791, who I'm sure is how all her friends know her, said innovation will cost you $30 a piece, right? Because
that's what Apple asked for.
That was the opening bid, was $30 a piece. Right. So what we're really talking about here, so Danny, you said, you know, you deserve to get paid if you come up with that. Okay, I'll buy that. But is the market really better off if every phone costs $30 more? Well, how is that served?
No, only Apple's better off, but that's the only... That's the point of patent law, is that the inventor gets to reap the benefits of their invention for a certain period of time.
But if the inventor holds you by the neck to do so, and the people...
That's the point of FRAND, and I agree. I mean, that's the point of FRAND licensing.
But then you invent your own other juncture or other way that you want to go and figure out a way to do
it. Yeah, it could be promoting innovation by saying, don't copy Apple, do it your own way.
Right, which is fine, or you take something that becomes a standard, becomes a norm that we all take, and now you can't do that. You have to do this if you use another device because of the way the patent structure is set up. I'm not trying to argue, throw it out, and you're right, Leo, that's a different discussion, but I think we have to get to some more fundamental issues here. Just as with copyright, we've struggled with what does it mean to own a copy. And how does that work in a world where copies are free to make and so on and so forth? I think we have to address the same fundamental issues when it comes to patents. And we are as a discussion, but I don't think we're there yet in thinking about what does this mean for the marketplace.
Oh, I think we are. And I think these big lawsuits, the Google Motorola versus Apple, Oracle versus Google, and now Apple versus Samsung, those big lawsuits are bringing it into the foreground. And I think that we are actually thinking about it.
Well, we may be, but who?
I think everybody is.
Like lawyers who are quite well off with this.
Well, yeah, but I mean, it's Apple won this round, right? They won this round. There are other cases that are still up against them, and it may be that down the line they're not going to win this sort of thing, and they may have the same side of incentive of saying, right, let's come up with our own solution to this. Let's do more of the cross licensing and all this other stuff. But you know, if it really was the case of, hey, we just wanted to pay $30 to do this or whatever, maybe you should have paid $30.
That's an awful lot.
What I find insane is when Google plunks down billions of dollars for Motorola, primarily because they want patents, or people with patent portfolios are getting huge amounts of money, even if people aren't necessarily using those patents, and it's just protection. It's like buying domain names, but worse.
Gina, have you ever taken out a patent?
No, I haven't.
Oh, Gina.
And I'm sure you've done things that were patentable.
Probably.
No doubt.
Yeah.
So did you, you know, and now you're in a startup where at some point investors are going to worry about this and so on and so forth. Mm-hmm. Have you gone through a Q&A with yourself about, gee, should I be looking at patents, or no, I don't want to, or I'd be a fool if I didn't, or?
I've thought about it in the context of doing this show. You know, it's interesting. I sometimes see software developers kind of on their resume, you know, list patents that they own as a good point, as a positive point. I always am kind of feel ambivalent about it. It's tough. Look, when you go into business, right, you have a patent that can raise your valuation. It can be something that's attractive to investors or not. I've never been in a position, I've never worked for a company that asked that I, you know, file a patent like Andy did at Yahoo. Andy Bayo wrote that great piece about how when his company was acquired by Yahoo, they encouraged engineers to file patents and said that they would only use them defensively. And so he did it because they got a little bonus if they did. And now his patents are being used offensively, and he's upset that his name is on these patents. And, you know, I think things like the Twitter's IPA, I figured it's Innovators Patent Agreement. That's something I would love to use in our company if we do go down the patent road. Honestly, it's not something that I've cared enough to do myself. I've never felt compelled to file a patent for my own work just for myself.
Right. And there's no point in filing a patent unless you're willing to go to court to defend it. Mm-hmm. And who wants to do that?
Right, exactly.
Unless you already have lawyers, you know, on retainer by the bushel.
Yeah.
it's not, you know, I we have that same issue. I trademarked Twit and the Twit logo because it seemed prudent. But then when I started pursuing people, I realized the cost of doing so was so high that it's not worth it. The cost I think the judge was alluding to this a little bit, in not merely financial cost, but the cost in your reputation. This impacts the reputation of both Samsung and Apple, and that's hard to measure. One doesn't know how that will play out. I think that in the long run, what's going to happen is these companies are going to sit down at the table and say, we don't want to do that anymore. In fact, I think if Steve Jobs hadn't conceived of this in the first place, Apple might not have gone this far down this road. This may be Steve Jobs' legacy more than anything else. Among some innovations Samsung talked about today at their Mobile Unpacked conference, besides the Galaxy Note 2, a new Galaxy camera. Apple doesn't have one of those. Running on Jelly Bean with a 16-megapixel sensor, built-in Wi-Fi, 3G and 4G, and Samsung's kind of, dare I say, patented, ginormous 4.8-inch HD LCD screen. That's an interesting product, huh? Apple doesn't have one of those.
Was the other camera with Android? Was it Nikon? No. Who?
Yeah, Nikon also has an Android camera, but it was running Gingerbread.
Right.
I think this also has Wi-Fi and 3 and 4G, which is really interesting. And it doesn't have Siri, but it does have voice control for when your hands are full. Photo management, shot share. Remember, that's the big thing they've been pushing with the Galaxy S3. And I like this. If you have an S3, you can use a remote viewfinder. Somebody else has the camera. I don't know why that's useful, but interesting. That's innovation.
Spying. Privacy.
Samsung innovates. I don't think there's any question about that. They also announced, and I think this is very interesting, a 4.8-inch Windows 8 phone, the Samsung Ative. And very much like the giant screen phones, this is the Windows RT tablet. They also are doing a Windows 8 phone. So this is the Ative Smart PC running WinNT, or RT. God, that's so confusing. Windows RT. And then they're going to do a phone name with the same brand name. So
very weird name.
Ative.
Like the way you're saying it, I would have never thought that that's how you spell it.
ATIV.
IV.
Probably stands for something.
Yeah.
They're going to do an ATIV tablet, also Windows 8. And the ATIV S, the Windows 8 device, phone, 4.8-inch screen, 2300 milliamp battery, 8-megapixel camera, NFC, chic hairline design. I don't know what that is. So I think Samsung, this is the message from Samsung. Okay, Apple, you got us on the fascinate, the captivate, but we're way beyond that now. We're doing different stuff.
Was there any mention of the suit? I presume not.
I doubt it.
No joke or anything.
No joke. No. Not that I know of. I wasn't watching, so I'm just...
Well, there are going to be appeals, and I mean, it's not...
It ain't over. Right.
Yeah. Yeah.
Far from it. Then nobody's paying any money for a long, long time. And meanwhile, a smartphone market is exploding internationally. This is an interesting article from the Flurry blog. The countries with the greatest number of active iOS and Android devices. U.S., of course, number one with 165 million. Then China, 128 million. U.K., South Korea, Japan. The fastest growing iOS and Android markets, though, China, Chile, Brazil, Argentina, Iran. 400% growth in China. Countries with the highest penetration of smartphones among adults. Singapore, 92% of Singaporeans use smartphones. 87%
wow.
in Hong Kong.
Wow.
86% in Sweden. U.S. is only 78%. That's higher than I would have thought, though.
Yeah, it is. And the interesting thing about the U.S. is that it's still holding that those numbers are higher in African-American and Hispanic markets. It's a leapfrog situation.
Yeah, right.
Where those markets are ahead in mobile and smartphone as a means of getting to the internet, which really is baffling media and other companies as to what to do about it.
I would love to see these numbers compared to computer usage. You know what I mean? Many of these countries, people are going directly to a smartphone, right? Because they don't have a computer in their living room. But in the U.S., right. many households probably, I would guess, have big screen computers.
Flurry says the rate of iOS and Android device adoption has surpassed that of any consumer technology in history. 10 times faster than the 80s PC revolution. Wow. 2 times faster than the internet. 3 times faster than social network adoption.
What about cell phones, per se, does it say?
Doesn't. Cell phone market grew pretty fast, but...
It was pretty fast, yeah, that's what I'm saying. Cell phone and cable... Well, cable, I guess, was slow from its beginning days.
640 million iOS and Android devices in use last month. 640 million. Which is interesting because there's 1 billion users on Facebook, but then only half of them are real. So I guess that makes sense.
That was also
that was interesting, was it? Yeah.
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 Only like 150 of them are real.
Yeah. Adam Curry, that's what he said. He said it was about 1/10 of the total number is actually people.
Yeah.
The rest
are on the moon.
The rest of them are on the dark side of the moon. So any day now, Facebook should hit 1 billion users, even though...
So let's talk about this for a second. Because there's been... as I was going through prepping for the show earlier today and just did the Google News search on Facebook, it's, you know, one after another of people slamming Facebook. Twitter's going to live and Facebook's going to die. Mark Zuckerberg, the company's worth a lot more if he leaves. Facebook's a disaster. 1 billion people are using it still.
But... This is why. I mean, if you have 1 billion users and you still can't figure out how to make money.
But they are just not enough yet. And they haven't.
Well, and less every quarter.
Well, that's the issue.
It's gone the wrong way, Jeff.
Got a good point there.
The number of users is going this way and the amount of money is going this way. That's kind of a I could see why the market might be a little antsy about the whole thing. They have to lick, and actually, Danny, you'd probably be good on this. They have to lick the mobile problem, right? That more and more people use Facebook, but they're all using it on mobile devices, which don't show ads.
Well, they can easily insert the ads whenever they want to get around to it.
It's different, though, isn't it? On mobile, you can, you know, we can ignore ads easily on big screens, but
if you're going into your news feed, you just, and they already are, insert items that are news items right. into the middle of your feed, and there right. they are. So, you know, that's or you do other things if you want. You start transforming any links to an outbound site into an affiliate link, and then that turns it into some money. There's all sorts of things you can do. I just get the impression they haven't been bothered to get around to doing it.
Yeah. You know. There's no hurry, is Mark Zuckerberg's attitude.
Well, now there's probably more of a hurry because, you know, you've got these investors that are freaking out because they're not going to make all this growth that they thought they were going to be getting, even though they're still making lots and lots of money. Right. But yeah, they can solve those sorts of problems if they want to.
Yeah, I mean, it seems like there's so many opportunities for mobile, for location-based ads.
Right? And there's no hurry. Really isn't. They're making you know, what is it, a couple of billion a year anyway, and they're fine.
I thought it was interesting. There was a survey where I think that people were saying they would spend like $10 a year to buy Facebook. And one of the things I wonder is if we'll get down the line where you not buy Facebook, but buy, you know, to buy an ad-free Facebook. But it would be interesting to see what happened if Facebook said, hey, you know, you're welcome to use the website for free. If you want the app, it's going to cost you $10. And whether people might decide, you know, it's valuable enough, I do want to pay for it.
Doesn't even have to be $10. What if it's $5 or $3 for mobile app?
Or $1.
$1.
Well, you say that, but I mean, people spend $1 on the stupidest games.
That's not the point. What's the essence of the business, Danny? If the essence of the business in the long run is that Facebook knows more about you than anybody else, and Facebook can then, when it finally gets smart advertisers, can target wisely. The question is not people will pay for it. The question is where will they make more money? And that's the issue constantly with media, is that, well, people should pay because they used to pay. That's not the point. It's completely beside the point. The point is, where do you best put your resources and effort, and where are you going to make the most money? And I don't think Facebook is ever going to make the most money by charging for itself.
No, I think that you have to go through that kind of balancing act. I think they could also do things, though, if they wanted to, where you get a Facebook premium app and put any old thing in there, and you're going to have people who decide they want to buy Facebook premium, and perhaps you even get surprised by what happens with it from there. You may have some people who really don't want the tracking and decide, okay, you know, you can pull the app net and flip it around and say, hey, you don't want to be the product? Okay, then pay $50 a year. Here you go.
Right.
But now, you see, the other thing is, and I deal with this with my students, when you sell a product, there is a customer acquisition cost that in the case of subscription products is much greater than the revenue you get in the first year to 3 years, because you don't really make it up unless people continue on. And so it's a huge investment to charge for a product. The New York Times spent $30 million to build its meter and then $13 million to operate it in the first year. Most of that is marketing.
If you take Apple, for example, I mean, I've got iCloud and it was free, right? But I needed more storage. They already made the investment to give me a certain amount of it. I shelled out the $25 on two different accounts for myself and for my wife just because I needed more storage. It was easier to do it. Wasn't going to be
Fine. That's fine. But that's not the essence of the Apple.
I see Facebook saying, okay, you've got 100 million photos that are up there. Do you want to keep them there? Do you want to keep this stuff going? Or do you want to have these additional things? This is what it's going to cost you. I guess I can just see them doing that sort of stuff. I agree with you. I don't think that's their big priority. I think it's even lower priority than what do we do about getting more mobile ads that are out there.
I think Foursquare is doing an incredible job of mobile. I don't click on ads. I generally don't interact with ads. I use Foursquare. Foursquare has this American Express.
I have made so much money on that.
I have too.
And it makes a great ka-ching sound.
It's awesome. It's an awesome user experience. It feels good. You feel like you're saving money. I mean, you have
But wait a minute. How can they be making money if they're giving me $5 back?
Well,
it's only once.
No,
they only
give
it to you once.
No, they don't. I've twice now gone to the same Chinese restaurant and I paid with, and I consciously pulled out my American Express card because of that deal. You have to check in. And then you have to hook up your card with Foursquare. And then it goes ka-ching, and I get $5 back. I had a $15 meal. I paid $10 for it.
I'll have to check on it again. Because I signed up for it. I did it twice. And then it was like, I didn't get it for the second time. I was like, what? I went through all this hassle to sign up to get $5.
It worked for me twice.
I've done it a few times. I think I've done it like 4 or 5 times. I mean, setting up, linking your card, I was sort of wary and I wasn't sure, but I was like, all right, let me try it. But once you do that, once you get through the setup, you just say like,
and then,
yeah, claim this on my card. And then
here's the scenario.
Pretty much every restaurant in Petaluma is doing this. I have saved so much money, but I don't think there's a, I don't think there's a business model. Was American Express giving them $5? Who's making money on this?
Let me give you one. Let me give you one. Right. I had entirely stopped using my American Express card. They did foreign exchange things. I couldn't stand it. They didn't care. I was, you know, member since 1970, whatever. They didn't give a rat's rump.
No,
I completely stopped, and I used my United Airlines card. Well, you know, I went to the U.S. Open and spent $25 here, which is easy to do. You know, it's like a hot dog. And we'll give you $10 back. So it brings me back in the fold, which goes back to the point about customer acquisition and retention costs. It's a marketing cost. That's all it is. It's making us talk about it right now. You're talking about it with your friends. People are using it.
So who pays it? American Express?
I think in great measure, yes. I'm sure there's a joint deal that goes across. There's value here for the restaurant. There's value for Foursquare. There's value for American Express. How that's divvied up, I have no idea. And full disclosure is I'm working with Foursquare for one of the companies I work with. And you're right. They're very smart and doing wonderful things, but they're just at the beginning stage. So at this point, they learn. Plus, the other value that comes out of this, we talked about this last week with Square, is the more they know about your transactions and can tie it to you and where you are and all this other data. One of the key things about Foursquare, when a media company ties up with Foursquare, is that they, and if the user, only if the user hooks together the sign-ins, right? So the user is saying it's okay for you to know who I am. Then the media company knows more about that user and where they go and what they want and so on than they have ever known. Ever. That data, if they can figure out, this is the heart of the Facebook problem. If they can figure out how to use that data and exploit it to economic benefit while still benefiting the customer, then that is where the value is. That's where the value of credit card companies is going to be and where Square is going to be. And that's what Foursquare can help bring about.
It's a huge promotion, and when I discovered it, I just used my. I've been using it like crazy.
Yeah,
it's $5. Doesn't cost me anything. I guess probably Foursquare makes 50 cents or something, right? American Express is probably paying.
I basically never do things like that.
Me neither.
I rarely interact with things like that, and that I just happen to love, and it's really well done. And I'll eat in a restaurant if I see the special. I'm much more likely to go eat there because I like the idea that I can check in and then it's going to get a deal. If that's something I would have been doing otherwise. Anyway, I just thought it up because I thought it was a really good example of mobile advertising
monetization. Yeah,
that is really interesting.
American Express could have spent $20 million on a commercial.
Right.
Instead, they divvy up that $5 at a time in happy user experiences that also bring them back benefit in terms of the relationship with the platform Foursquare and with their merchants. Because the merchant says, hey, man, people are using their American Express cards. This is great, right? And they learn more about you. You take the marketing money and put it here. That's the future of Facebook if they can friggin' figure it out. You replace marketing with relationships. That's you just made my argument for me. Thank you. I haven't been able to make it. The Foursquare Amex deal is a perfect example of that, where it's marketing dollars. So you look at this. Basically, they were paying $5 before for you to watch commercials. Why don't they pay $5 for you to get lo mein and be a happy customer, and they know more about you, and they've done all these wonderful things. So much better.
I must debunk an error I made. Remember when we talked about this incredible discovery of new Egyptian pyramids in Google Earth?
It was my error. I put it in the rundown.
No, I love the story, but unfortunately, an Egyptologist reports that now we've known about those since 1925. They're not pyramids; they're mounds. nothing to see here.
We appreciate the fact checking.
Yeah. Well, we gotta correct it. Paola Davoli, an Egyptologist at the University of Salento, in your homeland, Gina. says the features in Google Images have been well known since 1925 when they were surveyed by G. Caton Thompson and E.W. Gardner. They're natural mounds surrounded by a building and by dug wells. For sure, they are not pyramids. We don't know what they're for. Aww.
While we're talking about corrections, last week we talked about the Twitter API 1.1 changes, and I gave Twitter a very large benefit of the doubt. And since that episode, Twitter cut off access to Tumblr, to the social graph. You can no longer find your friends on Twitter. They had done this once before with Instagram, but it was kind of easy to write that off because you were like, well, Instagram's owned by Facebook and there's a little rivalry. No, they cut off Tumblr. They didn't really have a good reason why. That wasn't covered in the 1.1 API changes, but I just wanted everyone to be clear that I think it's totally crappy and I'm really disappointed and I'm no longer going to give Twitter as much of the benefit of the doubt as I did last week when we talked about
it. It doesn't even make sense, frankly.
It doesn't.
No, it doesn't.
It does not. And Jeff's rant last week about how this is our data, I was feeling the outrage. I had the Jarvis outrage going on. I was like, this is my friends list that I put together on Twitter, and I should be able to export it anywhere to any third-party app that I want, or to, you know, CSV or whatever. And it really bugged me that they cut Tumblr off.
You might want to take something for that feeling when it comes on, Gina. Let me tell you, it's not a good thing.
A meatball.
Be careful here.
I generally don't exist in a state of outrage. It just exhausts me.
So yeah.
Save it for the really, really angering things, and that got me. So I think that really sucks.
It's kind of a bummer, isn't it?
It is.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it's also goes back to the Samsung Apple discussion. It's we're living in and this is business, and I know it's business, and it's naive to think otherwise, but I think a lot of us have kind of a Sesame Street view that Sand Hill Road is Sesame Street, and that in the long run we all want to work together and we're all creating such neat stuff, and isn't this wonderful? And am I wrong to think that there's a lot more anger going on and fighting and things?
No, everybody's anxious and
the
upset.
The Facebook stuff is really, the Twitter stuff is really confusing because it just hasn't really felt very Twitter-like. I mean, I could see you wanting to like say, okay, Instagram, you're part of Facebook and we're not kind of getting along with Facebook right now. And I don't know what the status of Facebook shifting data back into Twitter is. I know that Facebook hasn't allowed Google to pull data, so you could see no loss between the two of those. But, you know, what happened? What's going on with Tumblr? Why? When did they become enemies? And why?
Tumblr's not even making any money. Greedy, and David Karp's a great guy, and I don't get it.
Well, you know, unless somebody's about to acquire Tumblr, and it's not going to be Twitter. Or there's some other things that are going on there going with it. But to what Gina was talking about, I had done this thing earlier this year when the whole fight was going on about what Google could or couldn't get from Facebook and could or couldn't get from Twitter and what Twitter was saying you ought to be doing. This was back when the whole Google Plus thing was going on and Facebook and Twitter were like, well, you know, you're favoring Google Plus more than you're favoring us. And Twitter and Google was like, well, yeah, well, we can't get half your data, so if you want to start giving us some of this data,
well, and then we'll talk.
And what I did is I wrote this thing called a proposal for social media to taunt, but in part of it, you can look it up, but part of it had this thing called the Bill of Social Data Rights. And what I was saying is, look,
that was a very good piece.
Thank you. But it was like, you know, anything I post publicly to Twitter or Facebook or Google, that's public. You don't get to hold on to it, and you don't get to block it from someone else. So if Google wants to crawl my Facebook post, Google can crawl it unless I've said you can't crawl it. Not Facebook says that they can't crawl it. And interestingly, Facebook apparently has just released this, just changed it now so that your private post. We had a thing on, I think, Search Engine Land that looked at this where it looked like that was opening up. The other thing was that our profiles, ourselves, what we do, who we're with or whatever, that sort of metadata that should be able to be included. And this goes to what you said, Gina, you know, your friends are yours. They're my friends, and I should be able to take those friends anywhere I want. And I mean not like the way Facebook does it where, okay, here's a list of names.
Yeah.
Right? If you've ever done it on Facebook, you go, oh, I export my friends. It's like, well, here you are. Here's 1,200 names. You know, it's like I get to take them with my Twitter URLs or all that other stuff. And what I said was, what is proprietary to the social network? What is your most valuable data? Is your social shares and your social actions. The interrelationships that we have on your social network between the people we know there, that's yours. Okay, we don't need to take that stuff out there. That's your secret sauce. That's your type of thing. You know, you want to do that, but the raw ingredients I should be able to take out. They don't belong to you. They belong to me, the user.
We need data liberation for third-party data liberation. You know what I mean?
Yes.
So tools that, and I'm sort of waiting for these to, and I'm to some extent building one, tools that help you extract your data from these networks and maybe, you know, import it into other. I mean, it gets. it gets complicated because there aren't standards for formats and that kind of thing. Everybody, you know, the companies that do offer data liberation or export do it in different formats. Facebook gives you a zip of HTML files and you know, Twitter gives you JSON or XML, whatever. But I think that this is going to become, you know, a bigger issue. And when the Tumblr thing happened, I thought, like, who's going to set up? I think Mark Jaquith from WordPress said this. You know, who's going to set up the pirate export my friends sites that then, you know, feed into Tumblr, you know, using the different APIs, kind of that third party app that's going to plug them into one another. But yeah, there's a big need for this. But who enforces this? Like, you know, is this a third party organization that's going to enforce this? Are we going to come up with principles or rules, and then different social networks, you know, either meet them or they don't?
Gina, you got to get angry, Gina. You got to get mad.
I think the users
and make barricades.
I think the users could get mad, but I think the big three, and I would count as the big three being Facebook, Google, and Twitter, have all been interrelatedly angry at each other. That at this point, they sound hypocritical not to support this stuff. It was funny when Facebook and Twitter came out with their Don't Be Evil tool to show what Google could have gotten off the public web if they wanted to put stuff into their Google Plus boxes for Facebook and Twitter. And yet Twitter looks stupid in the sense that you guys cut off access to Google to crawl your stuff. And to this day, we still cannot use Google, if we want to find stuff as well as we can on Twitter. Twitter don't even have a database that goes back past 7 days. Finding my own tweets is painful. I have to go over to Topsy, which is great. They've been the anointed alternative Google, and it's great for Topsy or whatever. But I'd rather search on Google. It's just the tool I want to use.
Brother.
And I can't do it because you don't want to have a deal with them, because we don't know. We don't know what it is. We don't know if they didn't want to pay you enough, or you thought it was too competitive, or whatever the deal was. We don't necessarily know from Google. All we know is you two couldn't make a deal over the ability for Google to index stuff that belongs to us. And so
you're mad as hell. We're not going to take it anymore.
Right. But so then when you a year later come around and say, well, Google's not being fair to us, it's like, well, what's your problem? Or when Facebook gets upset and they're like, well, Google isn't indexing enough of our stuff. It's like, okay, when we wanted to take our stuff out of Facebook and bring it over into Google, and you wouldn't let us do it, but we could do it for Yahoo. What's the point? I mean, you're just so. I think there's enough hypocrisy all around for the pressure to go on to them to say you need to stop fighting amongst yourselves and you need to pull it together. Realistically, I'm not optimistic.
Well, it's funny because Twitter wants it both ways, because there's a court battle going on right now in New York State. The Twitter's have filed an appeal to the New York Supreme Court saying our users own their tweets.
Uh-huh.
And that Twitter says that the users have a property right to the content they post and a Fourth Amendment privacy right to their accounts. Deleted tweets are not public, and Twitter accounts should have the same protection as personal email accounts.
All of which is God's work, and this is what can be about Twitter. That's why I love Twitter.
But the judge said, by design, Twitter has an open method of communication, and so this is really kind of an interesting battle in which Twitter, I think you're right, is on the side of the angels, is trying to protect us. But it's just, I guess it's good, when it's convenient for them, we own our tweets. When it's convenient for them, they own the tweets. It just depends.
I wouldn't have been that cynical. I am that cynical now. I wouldn't have been that cynical a few weeks ago.
Yeah.
I would have still wondered where the real Twitter is. I'm just starting to see it in the dark side.
Early in 2012, prosecutors asked Twitter for information about a protester during the Occupy Wall Street protest last year, Malcolm Harris. Twitter told Harris about the subpoena. He filed a motion to quash. The court denied Harris' motion and told Twitter to comply. In May, Twitter filed a motion to oppose that order. In June, the court denied Twitter's motion. And now in August, Twitter is appealing and filed the motion again.
The court said in part that the things that are made public are in fact public.
Public is public.
Before, and I agree with that. If it's been public, and even if you kill it, somebody recorded it somewhere, tough.
Right.
But what they're also going for is more information than that. They're going for identity. They're going for when and where it happened. They're going for other data that isn't public. And so Twitter is indeed doing the right thing. But I kind of like this, because maybe we can kind of use it on Twitter here.
Right.
And say, you're right. You're right. We do own it. It is ours.
Right.
So give it to us.
Or don't count on Twitter fighting for you for much again.
Yeah.
That might be gone. Google, this just in, Google is apparently tapping Barclays Bank to seek buyers for Motorola's set-top box business. Google,
that
of course.
Makes no sense to me.
Well, we had some question about what were they going to do? That Google makes set-top boxes, Google TV. But apparently it doesn't want that. It just wanted the smartphone business. Both were part of Motorola Mobility, which Google bought. They say it's worth about $2 billion. All right.
Well, it's a nice bit of money you can pull back in. What did they pay for Motorola again?
12,
six,
right?
Six, 12.
Yeah.
Pull in $2 billion. You don't got all the patents that you wanted. You perhaps you even keep some of the patents that were associated with it because you sell it and you get a cross-licensing type of thing. But
right.
I mean, set-top boxes...
I think that's a dead business, isn't it?
The future of your set-top box is an Apple TV or a Roku or maybe a Nexus Q if they ever fix it, right?
They're saying it's a dead business, I think.
Okay, yeah. I got it. So they will be in the set-top box business, but not this way. They want to be able to disrupt that business.
I don't know. We're going to take a break. Come back with your tools and tips and number of the week. But first, a word from our friends at Stamps.com. Who are disintermediating the post office. What they're doing is they're letting you print your own U.S. postage right from your computer and printer, so you never have to go to the post office again. You never have to wait in line. You never have to worry about whether you have the right postage. You always have the right postage with Stamps.com. And with their USB scale, you always know exactly how much postage you need. Never pay a penny more. You'll save money, too, because you get discounts from Stamps.com. You can't get at the post office, up to 21%. On U.S. Postal Service Express Mail, up to 15% on Priority Mail. It saves you a lot of time, too. It prints right on the envelope if you want. You can actually, if you're an Amazon or eBay seller, get the information from the buyer's page, and it just automatically prints it all out for you. So it really is a great time saver. And I've got a great deal for you. If you visit Stamps.com right now, you'll see there's an $80 offer on the front page. Don't take it. I'm telling you, I've got a better deal. Click the radio microphone in the upper right-hand corner, and you'll see if you enter in the offer code TWIG, you can turn that $80 value into $110 value, including $55 in free postage, the digital scale for free. You just pay shipping and handling, $5 supply kit, and a four-week trial. It really is a great deal. Try it now. Offer code TWIG at stamps.com. Click that microphone. And then... start printing postage. You don't need a postage meter or anything. I love it. Time, Gina Trapani, for your tip of the week.
Tip of the week, Microsoft SkyDrive, which I admit I haven't used. I signed up for a long time ago, but it's 7 gigabytes of free cloud storage, similar product to Dropbox or Google Drive, but a little more space. I think that they're kind of competing on how much space they give you, so you get 7 gigs. Their Android app is now available. It just became available this week. The iOS app and the Windows mobile app had been out for a while. So SkyDrive app for Android, pretty simple for now. You can upload multiple photos. You can open documents. It's got...
Oh, she froze. Much
like very jelly beanie. Oh, can you hear me still?
Yeah, you're back.
Okay, good. That's available for free in the Google Play Store now. And like I said, I haven't been using SkyDrive, but it's 7 gigabytes of storage, cloud storage. So, hey, why not? If you haven't looked at it in a while, check it out.
It's good for people using Windows and Mac.
And Mac. Yeah, and Android.
Actually, SkyDrive is this kind of unknown and good deal. It really is pretty cool.
It is. I mean, they offer more storage than Dropbox and Google Drive and quite a few of the others. Yeah. So,
Jeff Jarvis has several numbers to choose from. What do you want to pick
a
few? I don't care.
We could do Zuckerberg meets the oldest Facebook user, Florence Detlor, who is 101 years old. But
that's the number, 101.
We could do $18 million, which is how much the Winklevi have paid for a brand new home in the Hollywood Hills. But I won't do that because Citrix is involved. In a study looking at the percentages of people who are confused about the cloud. And
is it 100?
some of this is wonderful. 51% of respondents believe that stormy weather can interfere with cloud computing.
Of course it can. 51%?
A majority of respondents, 29, which is not a majority, 29% also think that the cloud is an actual cloud. I'm guessing that's...
What?
I'm hoping that's a punchline. It's like those ways that say, that 98% of Americans think Obama is an alien,
Yeah, no, it's how you ask the question.
Exactly. A survey found that 54% of respondents claimed to never use the cloud in their everyday lives, but in fact, 95% actually use something powered by the cloud.
Of course.
And the majority of respondents, 40%, not majority, but I think I mean plurality of respondents, see the major advantage of the cloud being able to work at home in the nude.
Come on, this is from The Onion.
This is, if you click on the link there, it's WebPro News. And it's a company doing something for Citrix, and I think with some humor involved.
Also. I think so. Wakefield Research. They did survey 1,000 Americans.
They found them in bars at 3 in the morning.
Yeah. But, what's the cloud? It's a little floaty thing up there. It looks like a goose. My tool of the week is Hoo-Ha. I just like the name. Hoo-Ha.
Yeah, you like that name?
I like the name Hoo-Ha. It used to be Jive, but Hoo-Ha is so much better. It is the first Android app free for app.net. And we talked with Dalton Caldwell of app.net. It's a paid kind of answer to Twitter, response to Twitter. It's not a Twitter clone, but the idea of app.net is that it uses open APIs, PubSub, HubHub, and things like that to make it possible for everybody to participate. And you have to pay, though, $50 a year to be a participant. Hoo-Ha looks strangely like, I don't know, kind of has that Google Plus feel to it, but I like it. And it's very easy to use, and I hoo-ha'd just a moment ago. And we've been looking for a new term. Not, you can't say tweet on app.net, so I think we might all hoo-ha.
Did you hoo or did you ha?
I ha'd and then I hooed.
I just RP'd you.
RP is the new thing.
RP is the new thing.
RP is the RT for app.net.
The RT of app.net.
Yeah. I don't know what to think about app.net, but at least, you know, what's amazing is the developer community has just leapt on it, and there's hundreds of, seems like maybe dozens of clients, and this is the first, you know, kind of Android standalone client, and it doesn't feel like it's 0.6, but it doesn't feel alpha. It feels very
they have, very but good. You know, I gotta say, there was a little thing that was coming up this week where I can't remember who was saying it was like, you know, oh, developers made Twitter, and I just sort of like thought, you know what, no, users made Twitter,
right?
And they still make Twitter, and right. Developers can make it easy, but if you hadn't developed a single thing for Twitter and it was still a website, there might have been people who still would have taken it up into some other area, and maybe they would have just built their own ecosystem. So I don't mean to be coming down on developers, but as an actual just tech user type of person or whatever, my world's not revolving around the development space.
Well, you got to have users, and so
you got to, and that goes to AppNet. It's, you know, it's great, and right. Every developer out there that wants to spend the $100 or $200 or $1,000, whatever it was, to get on there was, you know, you can go on it. But I don't need an app.net so developers have a better place to develop. I need an app.net because it's a better place for me to do the things that I cannot do as well on other services,
right.
Which this is aimed at Twitter, obviously. So if you've got something that's better for me than Twitter has, great. Right now, you don't got anything that's better for me than Twitter.
Right.
I can't shorten URLs. I can't share photos. It's not a very pleasant experience, but, you know, I'll keep playing with it.
I like it. It's nice, smart people in there. That's why I use it. But you're right. It doesn't have critical mass by any means. So it's not, you can't, like, if I wanted to know if somebody died, I can't go to app.net. I have to go to Twitter.
Yeah. I mean, one of Dalton's main premises is that developers made Twitter. And I'm, even though I am a developer and I develop on Twitter, I don't know that I completely agree with that. You need to build a product for users first,
right?
A platform becomes compelling when there are users.
Right.
So, but you know, listen, when we had Dalton, he did a great interview here and he said, hey, you know, do you remember what the Twitter homepage looked like when they first launched? I mean, he made the point that Twitter, you know, no one used Twitter and everyone made fun of what Twitter was in the very beginning too. And look what happened. So, you know, who knows?
Is Reddit still down? Let me just check. The president was doing an AMA on Reddit. Maybe he was. It's back up.
He wrapped it up.
13,340 questions. He answered 9.
And it's devolved into an analysis of his grammatical skills as well.
Oh, that's, of course. It's Reddit. What did you expect?
And failed to use an asteroid instead and said a asteroid.
So, oh, and it crashed again.
Oh, dear.
The Reddit fail hammer. Danny Sullivan, so great to have you. SearchEngineLand.com, MarketingLand.com.
Thank you.
Great sites.
I have one tip to think about.
I didn't ask you. You could do
it. I've got an interesting item. I worked one up.
Oh, good.
It's on the homepage of Search Engine Land. It's on the Google Inside Search blog as well. But, you know, Neil Armstrong died this weekend, which was really sad. And it really brought back a lot of memories, I think, of the whole Apollo missions. Mm-hmm. And I think that got Google thinking. And they went through and they looked at all the computing power used to make the Apollo missions possible from the whole period of the time that they had Apollo going on, you know, all the power that they had on the rockets, all the power they had in mission control and everything. And they said that all that power that they have is equal to the amount of power that now gets consumed when you do one single search on Google. And Google does 100 billion searches per month, so it's like they're launching 100 billion Apollos without the actual hardware, of course.
If we can send people to the moon, we can find Britney Spears.
Yes.
It's exactly what I was saying.
But can you get me nude
article.
Pictures of Britney Spears?
Like, it's like all that computing power being used so that we can search for Rebecca Black.
I don't know if I feel good about this.
But it's a sign of how cheap computing power is apparently now.
Yeah.
Or how advanced. So.
Yeah. I mean, the Apollo guidance computer ran at 40 kilohertz. They had five IBM Model 360 mainframe computers. They weren't really much faster. They were calculating liftoff data and orbits, monitoring biomedical data during the mission. Basically, your phone has more computing power than any of this stuff, all of this stuff put together. It's kind of amazing.
That's wild.
That's a Peter Norvig post.
Yeah.
Yep. Love it. Thank you, Danny. Really a pleasure.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
Jeff Jarvis, the author of What Would Google Do? His new book is Public Parts. You can read his blog post at buzzmachine.com. Great to have
you. Today, just so I don't make my students buy what I write, so I made Gutenberg the Geek free today, Wednesday, if you're watching live.
What?
On Amazon.
Just for your students, but anybody can take advantage. It's an Amazon single, Gutenberg the Geek. I already bought it, so I'll buy it again.
No, you don't. Well, you got it free.
I want to buy it again. Zero bucks for Prime members. Zero Kindle purchase. That's good. Yeah. But today only.
I'll do it again.
Waste no time. Gina Trapani, who is named after a town in Sicily.
Yes.
So don't mess with her.
Don't mess with her.
Trapani.
I just got some Trapani salt or something. It said Trapani.
Yeah,
yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. The salt, making salt is one of Trapani's main things that they do.
I said, I know her. I didn't know she made salt.
Oh man, I love salt. That's in my blood. If I could install a salt lick in my apartment, I would.
Me too.
Love it.
When Jennifer turned 50, that was her chief gift, was a salt lick. So I know what to give you when you turn 20.
Yeah. Oh yeah, 20.
30. Thank you, Gina.
Great to be here. Great show as always.
Thank
my
you, Danny.
Highlight of my
Thank
week.
Jeff. So much fun. Great to talk to you. We do this show every Wednesday, 1 p.m. Pacific, 4 p.m. Eastern Time, 2000 UTC on twit.tv. Watch it live, and then you could be part of the live fun, because there's always stuff before and after. You know, we dance, we sing, we talk about Chipotle. But if you can't watch it live, do watch the on-demand versions. Audio and video available at twit.tv/twig or wherever better podcasts are published. I'm Leo Laporte. Thanks for joining us. We'll see you next week, maybe with a better theme song. Because we still are using that crappy theme song.
People ask once in a while.
I haven't asked for one. Somebody sent me a Twitter saying, what is with that? I thought you were going to change that thing. We'll work on it.
We talked about it for a little while, and then
we gave up.
We'll keep talking about it.
If it had Chipotle, Habermas, Gutenberg
and
in it.
Glee. If it was from Glee, we'd use it.
If it was Glee singing it, we could live with that.
Let's get Leah Michelle in here.
Thanks, everybody. I asked my son. I actually did ask my son, and he never finished it, so I don't know. He's 18.
The Unfinished Symphony, perfect for us.
Yeah, that's
it. He's in beta.
That's I should tell him that. Yeah.
Yes.
So, ladies and gentlemen, enjoy this pan flute as we say goodbye from This Week in Google.
We could link arms if we did it right.
Wow.
Really good.
Wow. Nerdy.